Okay. Right, good evening. This is the parsha this week is Korach, but we're actually not going to be doing the sedra of the week. We're going to be looking at something else. The point is that this week on Thursday, it's going to be the third of Tammuz, Gimel Tammuz. And the third of Tammuz is the Yahrzeit of the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1994. And we are basically exploring his teachings, presenting the whole Torah tradition, and particularly the Kabbalistic tradition, through the lens of Hasidism, of Hasidic teaching. And so this is the Mayanot, the fountains of the inner spirit of Judaism that we are exploring with him. And so therefore, when it comes to the day that he passed away, that's a moment to focus on a particular teaching of all his teachings. Normally every week when we meet, we study one of his teachings. Mm-hmm. However, the one we've got in front of us now is the last teaching that he edited. Mm. Now, in order to understand what it means that he edited, we have to understand the way in which these teachings were delivered. From the time that he accepted the position of being Rebbe, which it's a very spiritual, special quality to be a Rebbe. Mm-hmm. Rabbi, Chief Rabbi Sir Jonathan Sacks defined the difference between a rabbi and a rebbe. See, a rabbi is like a rabbi of a synagogue, or he might be a chief rabbi of many synagogues. But a rebbe is something else. A rebbe is a leader of a Hasidic movement. So Rabbi Sacks defined the difference that a rabbi speaks to 500 people, and each one thinks he means the next guy, not me. And the Rebbe speaks to 5,000 people, and each one feels he's speaking to me. He's talking to me. That's the difference. Now, how you get that difference, you know, it's not a matter of taking a degree. It's something else. It's some special quality where the person feels that immediate contact. I knew a person, he told me, and this has actually happened to many people, but he said he had a certain problem on his mind, and he went to 770 in Brooklyn, 770 Eastern Parkway, the Rebbe's headquarters, and the Rebbe was just then giving a talk. And he came in, and he was like standing at the back, and he's listening to the Rebbe give this talk, and it's focusing on his problem that he's been worrying about. And the Rebbe was giving advice, speaking to hundreds of people in the hall. Right. But this person understood it as advice that was directly for him, for his problem. And it could well be there were a few other people in the room who felt exactly the same thing. So that's a Rebbe. So from the time the Rebbe became Rebbe, he would teach Hasidic discourses, these ma'amarim, which are the more Kabbalistic style of his teaching, and also a more general style called sichot. And very often these would be on Shabbat, and there was a group of scholars who trained themselves to be able to hear what he'd said and remember it immediately. Remembering it by heart. In the time of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, that's Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who passed away in 1950. So between approximately 1931, 1932 till 1940, he was in Poland. And I interviewed by phone an old gentleman now, lives in Canada. He's a teacher in a yeshiva in Canada. And he was then a student in the yeshiva in Poland, in Otwock, which is a country suburb of Warsaw. So it's a few miles out of Warsaw, and it's woodlands. I've been there. It's very pleasant country atmosphere. That's where the yeshiva was, among the woods. And so this student told me what it was like being in the yeshiva. He said that every Friday night, the Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, would give a discourse, would say a discourse, and 10 yeshiva students were allowed to hear it. No more than 10. The other people who heard it were the leading Hasidim, like older men, men of great experience and knowledge, and 10 yeshiva students. It was expected that each yeshiva student would remember by heart, just from that one hearing, the entire teaching. And on Shabbat day, each student would sit down with a group of people and say over by heart the discourse that he'd heard, which might run to like 7-8 pages of Hebrew text. And he would say, you know, various times during Shabbat to various different groups of people, so that all the 10 students were communicating, each one with a group here, another with a group there. And he said, if you couldn't remember it by heart, you wouldn't be allowed to be one of the 10 next week. So so either you could remember it by heart at one hearing, or you wouldn't.
That's right.
You'd be one of the people listening to, but not, you wouldn't hear it from the Rebbe. So there developed a group of such people around the Rebbe, and they heard everything by and learnt it immediately by heart. And then afterwards, after Shabbat had gone out, they would get together and they would go through exactly what the Rebbe said and write it down. And some of these things they wrote down, they would allow other people to see. And so eventually there became a whole a kind of industry of the unedited teachings of the Rebbe. And I remember in the 1970s making my own collection in kind of binders, you know, of unedited teachings of the Rebbe. And it always had to say at the bottom, unedited, like in Hebrew. It said, Bilti Muda. It always had to say, unedited. But there came a time when it was every week, there was another team who were slightly overlapping, and this other team would select one of these teachings of the past and would edit it, like a pre-edit, and then give it into the Rebbe, like preparing it for print. Like the Rebbe says, it says in the Talmud such and such. So where does it say in the Talmud? So they would look it up where it says in the Talmud, and they would put a footnote. And things like that, so that it was clear, it was given a clear presentation. And then they would give it into the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would add footnotes, or correct the inside of the text, or add a paragraph, or take out a paragraph. He often said that what is going to be printed is by its very nature different to that which is said. And he said that when you speak in a repetitive way. When you print it, you have to take out those repetitions. And so this is how he explained to the people who were writing down and preparing it for print with the Rebbe. So this is a teaching that the Rebbe said in 1981. But in 1992, it was prepared for print, and it was given to the Rebbe, and he edited it, checked it, edited it in different ways, and it was printed. And about 2 weeks later, the Rebbe had a stroke. And he never recovered from that stroke, and 2 years later he passed away. So this was actually his last edited teaching. It wasn't the last teaching he said, because he had spoken early in 1992, he had spoken as well earlier. And in fact, a week later, after this was published, he also spoke. But as far as an edited teaching is concerned, this is the last edited teaching. And it's a very interesting teaching, and it's very suitable as the last teaching of the Rebbe. Now, you see, there's a certain background to this idea of the last teaching of the Rebbe. What would make one feel that the last teaching he gives is so significant? The point is that the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who passed away in 1950, he also had a last teaching, which he gave out to be printed. And it was printed and distributed, and he said he wanted it to be studied on the day of the 10th of Shvat. And the 10th of Shvat, he passed away. So the reason why he said the 10th of Shvat ostensibly is because that was the Yahrzeit of his grandmother. So it was in her honor, as it were. But he passed away on the 10th of Shvat. And this was understood as his last will and testament, as it were. And that teaching, his successor, our Lubavitcher Rebbe, paid tremendous attention to that teaching that his predecessor, his father-in-law, had left as his final teaching. So it seems perfectly correct and appropriate that we should look at the last teaching of our Rebbe with the same kind of significance. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a teaching on the Sedra Tetzaveh. Tetzaveh is in the book of Exodus. Now, there's something interesting about this Sedra, because there's the book of Genesis. Moses only comes up in the book of Exodus. So the book of Genesis doesn't mention Moses. But the book of Exodus, Moses is born in the first Torah portion in the book of Exodus. And he's mentioned in every single Torah portion after that, till you get to the book of Deuteronomy, which is actually Moses' own words. It says these are the words that Moses said to the Jewish people. So the whole book of Deuteronomy is like Moses speaking, and it's all in the first person, him speaking to the Jewish people. But there's one Sedra where Moses' name is absent, and that's this Sedra, Tetzaveh. This Sedra Tetzaveh does not have the name of Moses. So if you were going to pick a Sedra where the Rebbe's last teaching is going to be about that, the teaching is about Moses. What is the function of Moses? Wow. So it's like, what is the function of Moses when Moses isn't there? That's really what it's saying. What's the function of Moses when Moses isn't there? Now let's just have a look at the beginning of this Sedra, Tetzaveh. V'ata Tetzaveh. You see, we're looking at the Hebrew text of the Torah. V'ata. Now, there's a way in which Moses is there, actually. The word you. V'ata and you. Meaning you, Moses. But the word Moses isn't mentioned. In the English, he's put it in brackets. But in fact, Moses' name is not there. So he's not visibly there. He's there in some sense. V'ata tetzaved b'nei Yisrael. You, Moses, you should command the children of Israel. V'yikhu elecha, and they should take to you, shemen zayit zach, oil, olive oil, which is pure. Katit lama'or, beaten. That means that's how you get the oil out of the olives. Lama'or for the luminary. Laha'alot ner tamid, to set up a continual light. Ba'oil moed in the tent of meeting, michutz la'parochet, outside the curtain, asher al ha'edut, which is in front of the testimony, you've got the Holy of Holies. And then you've got a curtain, and then you have the menorah. See, there's the. One second. It's been very helpful. You have the. In here is the golden ark, the Ark of the Testimony, and it's got like staves so that it could be carried, and there's cherubs which are above the ark. Mm-hmm. Here is a kind of a curtain, then here is the further part. So this is the holy part, and this is called the Holy of Holies. And in this part, you have a menorah. So there, just in the holy part, not the Holy of Holies, there's a menorah with seven branches and a golden table and a golden altar. And then outside, you have a courtyard with the altar. There's the main altar. So that is what the sanctuary looked like. Now, later on, this sanctuary was taken to Jerusalem, and eventually it was built into the stone temple that King Solomon built. And that part of it is the west wall of the temple. And there are different views about exactly where the Holy of Holies is, but one view is it's where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is.
Oh, right.
So that's an opinion. So there we have, so that back wall, in the case of the temple in Jerusalem, that back wall is the west wall that we go to in Jerusalem.
Right.
So there is the idea of setting up this lamp, but in the context of the Torah portion, it's talking about in the portable sanctuary that was traveling through the desert. Yaruchoto Aaron uvanav, Aaron and his children should set up this lamp, his sons, because his sons are like Kohanim with him. Me'erev ad boker, from evening till morning, lifnei Hashem, before God. Chukat olam l'dor atam, it's an eternal law for their generations. Me'et b'nei Yisrael, from the children of Israel. Now this seems like, you know, like so many texts in the Torah, it's sort of, in a sense, inscrutable. You know, it's speaking about some detail of something or rather that happened in the time of the sanctuary. In fact, the way in which the Rebbe explores this, it's going to become a teaching which is very relevant to the Jewish people throughout the generations. So that's what we're going to explore in the text of the actual discourse. And in order to get into the discourse, we usually start with the melody of the discourse, because the discourse is really a stream of teaching which is coming from a higher realm. And so we are going to try and make access to that stream of teaching, and let it enter our minds and our hearts. Oh, yo, yam, ba, yam, ba, yom, ba, boom. Oh, yira, yira, yom, ba, boom. Oh, yom, ba, ba, yam, ba, yom, ba, boom. Ha, yira, dam, ba, ya, yira, dam, ba, yom. Oh, ya yiridam ba ya ya yo, ya yiridam ba yam ba yo, ha yiridam ba ha yiridam ba ho, yam ba yam ba ya yam ba, oh ya yam ba ya ya yam ba, ho ya ya ho ya ya yo. Now we're looking at the next the actual Hebrew text.
Oh.
Okay, so
at the beginning.
Here. Oh, okay.
First phrase.
All right. Okay.
The
letters will shine. He's quoting from the text we just read. You should command the children of Israel, v'yikhu elecha shemin zayit zach, and they should bring to you olive oil, pure katit lama'or, beaten for the lamp, for the luminary, lahalot ne tamid, to raise up an eternal light. V'yiduim hadiyukim bezeh, it's known the questions asked about this in previous discourses of the previous Rebbeim of Lubavitch. You see, the point is that there are, from Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, he passed away in 1830, there are 18, 20 volumes of his teachings. Then there's his son, Rabbi Dov Ber, a whole lot of volumes of his teachings, maybe another 20, 15. And then, no, 20, I'd say, yeah. And then his son, his son-in-law, that's the third Rebbe, about 50 volumes of teaching, you know. Like, okay. So there's hundreds of volumes of teachings of this sort of Kabbalistic Hasidic material. Absolutely amazing treasure of wisdom. So it's known, and then so on. Our Rebbe was the seventh Rebbe, and each of the Rebbeim before is distinguished for having written and taught an enormous amount. So, it's known the questions asked about this. For example, the v'chol ha'tzivuyim shebatorah, in all the commands that are given in the Torah, Nehemiah, it says, tzav et b'nei Yisrael u'chayot zibo, command the Jewish people, and similar. V'cha Nehemiah, but here it says, v'ata tzaveh, you command the children of Israel, et b'nei Yisrael. Why does it add the word you? Now, we note that Moses' name is not mentioned in the Torah. Usually it says, God spoke to Moses, saying, command the Jewish people to do this and this. That's a very common way in which things are written in the Torah. Here, the Sedra begins, you command the Jewish people. Olo Hosif. Now, there's another point. The question about these words, hulor akbar lashon, is not only about the expression that's used, but also elegama tochen, also the content. What does it mean? The lashon va'atat tzaveh, if it says you should command, mashva, that implies shemoshe hu hamatzaveh, that Moshe is the one commanding. But that's not the way it really is. But tzarich lahavim, we have to understand. Hashuli, hari Moshe hu ashliach. All that Moses is, he's the emissary of God. Limsol Israel, to give over to the Jewish people, et tzibuyei hakadosh baruch hu, the commands of God. When it says command the Jewish people do this and that, it's God's command, and Moses is just saying, you should do this and that, because that's what God has commanded. It's not Moses who's commanding, it's God who's commanding. God is the one giving all the laws. The Rambam says, quoting from the Talmud, if anyone imagines that there is one word in the Torah from Moses' own mind, they are not fulfilling proper Jewish belief about the nature of the Torah. Jewish belief is that the Torah is from God. It comes through Moses, like a kind of, as the Rambam puts it, a mysterious kind of divine dictation. But it's channeled through him, but it's not him himself. So that's another question. Why does it say you should command? V'gam tzarech la'avin ma shekatuv v'yikhu alecha. And also, there's, you know what, there are some more points, but, alright, let's take these points. Maybe we'll be able to touch on them. Why does it say, v'yikhu elecha, that they should bring the oil to you, sh'yaviyu ha-shemen l'moshe, elecha, they should bring the oil to Moses, to you. T'lecha'ora, at first sight, kibun sh'ahalat ha-neirot ha'ita al yedei Aaron. It wasn't Moses who lit the lamp. This lamp, it was Aaron who lit the lamp. They should have brought the oil to Aaron, not to Moses. Why does it say bringing the oil to Moses? Lamu tzrach laviyat Hashem in leMoshe. Why is the oil brought to Moses? Gam tzarech lahavim ma shekatuv shemen katit lamo'or. The whole idea of oil which is beaten for the luminary. Why the luminary? It should have said oil lahair, to illuminate. And also, in the next verse it says, Me'erev ad boker. We read the second verse. It said, from evening to morning. That's when this menorah shines, from evening to morning. They light it in the evening and it burns till the morning. V'cha ne'emar lahalot ne'er tamid. But here it says, an eternal light, that it burns all the time. So there are various other questions. Okay, I don't know how many of the answers to these questions we'll be able to touch on. But let's try at least a little bit. All right, we're in chapter 2. And the first question is, why does it say Moses should command the Jewish people? And the way in which he approaches this is based on a teaching by the previous Rebbe. Now, the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, he gave a teaching which is a famous teaching, which he said in 1927. And he said it at what's called Purim Katan, Little Purim. There's Big Purim, which is on the 14th of Adar. Mm. Now, if there are 2 months of Adar, which there sometimes are, Big Purim is on the second Adar. But then the 14th of the first Adar, a month earlier, is called Little Purim. So it's we don't do the things that we do on the main Purim, but it's got a certain happy atmosphere. So on the Little Purim in 1927, now 1927, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe was in Russia. Right. He was in a town called Rostov. And it was the time of the Bolsheviks. And it was a very difficult time. Judaism had been banned in Russia, especially the teaching of children. And Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the previous Rebbe, had organized through his followers all over Russia a system of secret chadarim, secret Hebrew schools for little children, and other Jewish things as well, all illegal. Or even if it wasn't officially illegal, unofficially, the government, and particularly the NKVD, and particularly the Yesvektia, the Jewish section of the NKVD. There were lots of Jewish communists, unfortunately, who were passionately concerned to wipe out Judaism. So they were trying very hard to stamp out every vestige of Judaism. Even if you go to the books of what was actually on the statute book, this was permitted, but still the ardent Jewish communists would try to do their best to get rid of it. So
so people couldn't practice their Judaism openly?
No, no.
Not at all.
Well, it was very dangerous to do so, and the leading rabbis of the time all left Russia if they were able to, and Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak stayed as long as he could in order to strengthen Judaism in Russia. And the point is that a few weeks after he said this teaching in 1927, he himself was arrested and condemned to death because of organizing Jewish study for children and things like that. And then, thank God, on the 12th of Tammuz, which will actually be next week, next Shabbat, not this Shabbat, but next Shabbat, he was freed. First of all, he was freed, and he was told instead of, he wasn't freed, he was told instead of being executed, he would be sent into exile in Russia. And then he was told a week later that he wouldn't be in exile, he's just being asked to leave Russia. And basically that meant he was going free, but he couldn't come back to Russia. And he eventually lived in Riga, and then in Warsaw, and then in 1940, thank God, managed to get to America. So this previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, he explains the word that we are translating as command means something else. So we've got the root tziva, which means command, that's metzaveh. But we also have a word in Aramaic, tzavta, which means connection. Mm. Connection. There's a modern Hebrew word, tzevet. A tzevet means a crew who are all bonded together.
That's what Moses is doing.
This is so connecting. Moses is connecting the people. That's what it's talking about. He's not commanding them. He's connecting them. That's the important image over here. So, umavayim. So here we're looking at the next paragraph. or Mevaya, and it's explained by Kvod Kedushat Mori v'Chami Admor, by the previous Rebbe, in his well-known discourse of 1927, that the word Tzivui Tetzaveh, that in this case, the word Tetzaveh, command, Hutzavta v'Chibur, means a connection and a bond. In fact, whenever we talk about a command from God, that itself is a connection and a bond. When God gives us a command that we should eat kosher or something like that, have a mezuzah on our door, that itself is a connection with God. So by doing that thing, we are having a connection with God. In fact, even in simple human terms, if you imagine two people who don't have very much relationship with each other, but then one of them asks the other one to do something, that immediately is establishing some kind of connection between them. You know? Yeah. So there is this sense of connection. And so when it says Moses should mitzaveh, it actually means Moses should connect. So what is it? Who is he connecting? Va'ata tetzaves b'nei Yisrael, you should connect the Jewish people. In other words, Shemoshe hu mekasher, Moses is the one who bonds, umechaber, and connects at B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, im or ein sof, with the radiance of the infinite, with God. We all have, every human being in the world has a relationship with God, and every human being in the world has probably got some sort of awareness of God. There's some whose awareness takes a negative form, like a certain chap living in England today who writes book after book about how he doesn't believe in God. Richard Dawkins, yeah? Yes, he writes one book after another, and it's like Shakespeare said, "Methinks the lady doth protest too much." So deep down, he's a fanatical disbelief, but the focus on God is—it's an amazing focus. You know, God is whether the concept of God is used in positive ways or in negative ways, but the concept of God is there on the table. Someone wrote a book called *The Revenge of God*. He said after the secularism of the 19th century, like first the 18th century Enlightenment, then the 19th century. So you would think God was forgotten about, but in fact, you know, the whole politics of the world and this and that, it's all revolving around the concept of God in one way or the other. But although everyone is conscious of God, or many people are conscious of God, to what extent is one joined with God? To what extent is this a positive, meaningful element in a person's life? And that's where figures like Moses come into the picture. Because the Moses, it's not only one Moses at the time of bringing the Jewish people out of Egypt. As far as the Jewish people are concerned, there's a Moses in almost every generation, all the way through, there's a Moses. And all sages, and in a sense each individual has a spark of Moses within them. Moses means, and among people in general, Moses means the one who is able to infuse that spark within the person so that he or she are able to connect with the divine. And that is something which is, that's the role of Moses, to remind, to arouse, to inspire. And Moses is the one who connects the Jewish people with the radiance of the infinite. V'al yedei shemoshe mashpia liYisrael, through the fact that Moses gives this influence and inspiration to the Jewish people, shemakashe otam im or ein sof, that he bonds them with the radiance of the infinite, Al yidei zeh, through this, na'aseh yitaron v'hosafa b'moshe. Moshe himself grows through this. The quality of leadership is by the fact of the positive dimension of leadership and the people responding, the leader himself grows in the power of leadership. It's an interactive movement. If you imagine a musician is going to play their musical instruments in front of their family. You know, so that's two or three people, four people. And they play. And, you know, they can get very carried away and deeply into the music. But then you imagine that instead of it being their family, it's a whole audience of 120 people packed into the room. It gives them a kind of an extra depth to what they are able to achieve. It's there's some kind of interesting interaction which takes place, which Hasidic teachings discuss in the personality of people, the way in which there are certain qualities which are expanded by the fact of there being an audience, or the image is given of a king and a people. So you can't have a king without a people. So you could have a large family, the 35 people, 40, 50, 60 people in the family. So no one is the king. It's, whereas if you have a actual, you know, people who are not the relatives, but it's like really the people of the country, and the king has a role in leadership of this people of the country, it brings out certain regal qualities, a certain level of distance and of a kind of positive dimension of charisma, which wouldn't be there otherwise. So that means that Moshe, through the fact that Moshe is able to bond the Jewish people to God, this gives him more spiritual power. That's why it says that the oil should be brought to Moshe, not to Aaron. Because we're talking about the spiritual quality of Moshe, and the more that Moshe has got that spiritual quality, the more he is able to help the rest of the Jewish people and the rest of the world. That's the interaction. And it gives, here in brackets, it gives a kind of an image of the head and the feet. So there's like the head is like Moshe, and then the rest of the body and the feet, that is like the rest of the Jewish people. All right, so there we have the idea of the input, Moshe connecting the Jewish people to God, and through that, some extra dimension which comes to Moshe himself. So if we look on the last three lines of this paragraph, on the next page, page Lamed Hey, V'zehu, and that's what it means, V'ata tetzaveh. You have that, it's page Lamed Hey, last three lines of this first, of this second paragraph. V'zehu v'ata tetzaveh b'nei Yisrael. This is what it means, you should command, you should connect the Jewish people to God. V'yikhu elecha shemen zayit, and they should bring to you olive oil, pure olive oil. That through the fact, Shemoshe yitzaveh v'yikashed b'nei Yisrael im oim tzof. Through the fact that Moses, bonds the Jewish people to the radiance of the infinite, through this, the Jewish people, Yaviu b'nei Yisrael, shemen zayit l'Moshe, they bring this olive oil to him, which means they add to the radiance of Moshe. So it's an ascending quality of radiance going higher and higher. Okay. Ulevayezeh, Gimel. So we have the idea that Moshe and the type of person like Moshe, like Moses, through the generations, connects the Jewish people to God, and we're going to try and explore that idea a little bit further. Because that really is what this discourse is about. It's about leadership. What is the function of the Jewish leaders through the generation? See, there we have these wonderful books of Talmud. Each one of these volumes, you could spend several years studying all the different things which are in it. And so if ever you're on a desert island, you have nothing to do, just make sure you bring these books with you. Even if you don't have internet connection. Now, so the books of the Talmud are about the sages of the Talmud. On every page, there are a dozen names, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, Hillel, Shammai, you know, like, it's these great leaders of the time, of the sages, of the Mishnah and the Talmud. It's their teachings, and each one of them has got this kind of Moses-like quality. That's what they are. That's why Judaism consists of studying the teachings of these great sages. So let's try to understand this further. And to understand this, that's chapter Gimel, chapter 3. Magdim Bahamaima, it says in the discourse by the previous Rebbe, the discourse of 1927. See, he's referring back to that earlier discourse. Shemoshe Rabbeinu Nikra Raya Mehemna. Moses, our teacher, is called Raya Mehemna. Have you heard of Raya Mehemna?
No.
Really? Have you?
When you spoke about it before.
Okay. All right. Well, Raya Mehemna appears in many guises. Raya Mehemna is really a section of the Holy Zohar, and it's called Raya Mehemna. And Raya Mehemna means the faithful shepherd. Does it mean the faithful shepherd or the shepherd of faith? Mm. We're going to explore that in a moment. But sometimes the word Raya Mehemna is used for other things. It's like, but that's basically what it is. It's a section of the Zohar, and it means the shepherd of faith. And that section of the Zohar, there's a tradition that is actually written by Moses. It's teachings of Moses which were somehow transmitted until Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the Zohar, organized them into the text of the Zohar. So that is Raya Mehemna. Now, Raya Mehemna means literally the shepherd of faith. And what does that mean? The Shnei Perushim Bezeh. There are two ways of understanding this. One is Shehu Roe Ne'eman Shel Yisrael. He is the faithful shepherd, leader of the Jewish people. The idea of Moses being a shepherd, there is a beautiful midrash that before Moses was selected by God to carry out this task of taking the Jewish people out of Egypt, he lived in Midian and he was a shepherd. That's the whole story with Moses begins after he's born, like the thing about him being born, put in a basket in the Nile. But eventually he runs away from Egypt and he lives in Midian, and he lives there for many, many years, and he gets married. And while he's there in Midian, he's a shepherd. So God watched the way in which he behaved as a shepherd. And he saw that he was very careful with the sheep, that the sheep that was very delicate, he gave it delicate grass, and the sheep that was stronger, he gave it a stronger grass. So he was very, and there was one little sheep that ran away, and he ran after it a little, and he looked after it. So God said, if you're such a good shepherd, you can come and shepherd my people. That's how the Midrash puts it.
You talked about it also in connection with a black sheep and a white sheep, and a black and white sheep.
Wow.
Uh-huh. You did, because you talked about it and compared it to Mendelian genetics.
All right. I've read it.
And you told another story.
Okay.
But it was the Raya.
All right.
Or maybe that was in connection with David, King David, and Jonathan.
Maybe. Look, it sounds an interesting answer. Which we'll have to.
You taught it.
I
don't. Well, it makes me feel better about not remembering exactly.
Now, so one way of understanding what it means, faithful shepherd, is that he's the faithful shepherd of the Jewish people. That's one concept. But in the second half of the second line, a second way of understanding it, Israel, is that he feeds and supplies the Jewish people with faith. So in other words, he's the shepherd of faith, meaning he pastures us, the flock of the Jewish people, with faith. So he enables us to imbibe faith. That concept, that someone else, outside oneself can inspire a person with faith. How do you feel about that idea?
Well, would we be here if we didn't somewhere accept something like that?
I accepted.
Or hope for something like that.
I mean, I think it's a very practical reality in many aspects of life. Running a business. You have the senior exec, you know, the director, whatever he's called, you know, a head of a large company, who has a vision. And the rest of the people in the company, and you know, and there's risks involved, and you have to be dedicated. It's going to mean staying up late hours and working very hard. But they respect the vision of the leader, and they follow him. They trust in that vision. You know, it's a very practical, commercial thing. That it's a quality of trust in that vision. In politics, you have the same kind of thing, people trusting in the vision that some political leader has got. In more sort of personal areas, could be a group of people climbing a mountain. So they have a guide, they have a leader, the leader of the group. And you know, there's a terrible storm, there's a thunderstorm, they can see over there, and there's a snowstorm over here, and he says, come, we'll go this way, I've got the right way, we can go, we'll be okay. And everyone just trusts in that, we'll be okay, you know, he says, we'll be okay. And they find, you know, so the idea, whereas if the worst thing, a friend of mine, very elderly gentleman now, but he used to lead the RAF mountain rescue team, and he would take people mountain climbing. And one of the worst things that happened was that while they were climbing, he was climbing with a group of teenagers, Jewish teenagers, as it happened, Bnei Akiva group. A rock fell on his head. And was most like terrible, you know, like blood pouring from. Now, the most desperate situation is a group like this on a mountain, and the leader is wounded in some way, you know. And he described to me, he said, "Is my ear still there?" He says to them, "Yes, it's still there." Okay, well, there's no problem. Like he couldn't feel him.
Oh dear.
So that ability to that concept of a leader, well, in spiritual terms, there are also leaders who inspire with faith. They inspire people with faith. And you see, there is perhaps a Christian way of looking at the concept of faith, that faith is something which like suddenly happens to a person. They see the light, and they're imbued with faith. And of course, even then, you know, this may be generated by other people around them as well. But in Jewish thought, faith is something that you work on. You work on faith. And just as you have guides in other aspects of life, there are guides in faith as well. There are guides which help a person focus, emunah. The Hebrew word for faith is emunah. And the word emunah is interesting. It relates to the word omanut, which means art or craft, something that you learn. You learn how to do it, how to be a carpenter, or how to paint a painting. So that quality of art and faith, something that you work on. However, the discourse asks the question, why should the Jewish people need to have anyone who inspires them in faith? surely the Jewish people have faith in themselves. They by birth, as Jews, are the chosen people with a special heritage. Surely each person has got a spark of faith in themselves. You might say every human being has got a strong measure of faith within them. Well, you see, it's true. Third line down. The ha'emunah she'yeshna b'Yisrael mitzad atzman. The faith that the Jewish people have within them, as of themselves. She'Yisrael hei ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim, as the Talmud tells us, the Jewish people are believers, the children of believers. Efshar she'tiyeh b'fchinat makif. It could be in a superficial way. Now, this is one of the problems with faith, which the Talmud describes in an intriguing passage. It says a thief who is stealing, he's breaking into a house, and he's trying to steal from there. He prays to God. He prays, please, you know, I mean, these are pious thieves. Of course, you need a certain amount of religious education. You know. But let's say, you know, a mafia figure who is about to do something personally very dangerous. He might well pray to God.
A religious political leader in Israel.
He may well pray to God to help him, even though what he's actually doing is stealing from someone or even murdering someone. But He's praying to God because he believes in God. So you know, suddenly while he's trying to open the safe, he hears the sound of the police car driving along towards where he is. He says, "Oh God, please make them not catch me. You know, protect me." And then it fades away in the distance. You know, thank you God. And then he goes on opening the safe. Yeah. So it says in the Torah you mustn't steal. Everyone in the Western world knows it says in the Torah you mustn't steal, or in the Middle East, everywhere. You mustn't steal. And nonetheless, that's what he's doing. Now, how can that be? You can have a faith which it doesn't lead to real action. And unfortunately, this is actually a major problem. Yeah, people may not be thieves, but there are lots of other problematic things that people do, even though at the same time they claim that they believe in God. And that inconsistency in people is a very problematic aspect of what it means being a human being. So what does it mean? What's the effect of Moshe? He takes the superficial, possibly superficial faith that a person has, and draws it into the person. Now, that's the idea.
Deepens it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or internalizes it. It's as if that's the person. And then you have this power of, like, faith around them. And there it is just around them, but if it comes into them and into their mind and into their heart, then it's something which is felt. Then it's something that they are really aware of, and it's something that they feel, and as a result, that's going to actually govern their action. That's the effect of Moshe. And that's the effect of these rabbis in the Talmud. They establish that the Jewish identity of a person. There are many people who feel a very passionate Jewish identity, but it doesn't necessarily lead them in a particularly Jewish direction. It's there, and they feel this strong Jewish identity. And meanwhile, they might do this and they might do that, you know, all kinds of things that as Jews they're really not supposed to do. And so, or they miss out on doing things they should be doing. So the fact of this faith, this connection with God, becoming something internalized, makes the person into a more consistent person in this dimension. So that means Moshe roeh mefanes et Yisrael be'inyan ha'emunah. he feeds them with faith in such a way, that the faith should be in an inwardness, it should be internalized. And in fact, the Zohar speaks about this, that Moshe himself is the one who helps the Jewish people internalize faith. And so it is, it goes on, the line beginning Gam, about seven lines down in this paragraph. This is Gam li'it pashtuta de Moshe shebechol dor. This is also in the Jewish leader who is the spreading out of Moshe in every generation. The Roshei Alfei Yisrael shebechol dor, the leaders of the Jewish people in all the generations, they strengthen the faith of the Jewish people of their time. That it should be in an inward way. Now, because it is coming before Purim, when this was originally said, he then gives the example of Mordechai. Mordechai in the story of Esther. Mordechai was a very interesting figure because he was a leader of the Jewish people at a time when many people were not religious, were not observant. And nonetheless, Mordechai was someone who helped to unify the Jewish people at that time and to stand up for being Jewish, because basically that is what the Megillah is about. Or there are many like stories happening at the same time within the Megillah. It's a very mysterious book, but he's strengthening this sense of the identity of the Jew, and Mordechai is able to do this. That at the time when now the Midrash tells us that in the time when it was forbidden to study Torah and it was forbidden to keep mitzvot, and to do so was something which really people risked their lives. Now, the rabbis describe this about the time of the Romans and also the time of Haman and Mordechai. The point being that in the Kabbalistic tradition it says that if the Jewish people would have said to Haman, we accept your religion, they would have been saved. But instead, the Midrash tells us that Mordechai gathered large groups of Jews and they studied Torah together. And so he did this to strengthen the faith of the Jewish people, and so it is to all the generations. So in this way, that is the bringing of the oil. Remember, it says that it was the oil from the olives which had been beaten. Now, the being beaten is the way that when we are crushed in exile through all kinds of negative situations, that brings an oil of self-sacrifice, of dedication, of determination to be Jews. I mean, it's an amazing thing. Sometimes, you know, you can read stories of the time of the Holocaust, or indeed in Soviet Russia. There are books about people who were in the time of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, 1927, this period when people were arrested and tortured and stuff like that, simply because they kept Judaism. And the way in which the those who were trying to survive as Jews. I know a family, they were living in Russia in the 1920s and 30s, and they wanted to remain Jewish. And they knew that if their children went to school, the children would be turned into little communists, and they would report on their parents. They would be told to report, you know, do you see your mother light candles on Friday night? Yes, Tavarich, yes, I do see... you know, and so then the mother would be arrested and the whole family would, you know, so they didn't want to send their children to school. So how are they going to get out of sending their children to school? They decided they're going to live in the forest. So they moved into the forest. So and that's where they lived. So I was told about them by another little boy who's now an old man, and he was describing how he did go to school, and he was very proud of his exam results because he got a high result. He was like 7 years old. He got a high result, which meant he could stay in the school, but if he'd have got a low result, he'd have been thrown out. So he was very proud he got a high result. And anyway, it came to May Day, when there was going to be a big parade with everyone wearing red. So although his parents had agreed that he should go to school, somehow it was a bit too much that he should be in the May Day parade, so they decided to keep him at home from school. And in fact, what they're going to do is visit their friends who live in the forest. So they went along to the forest, like drove out of wherever it was, you know, took a train or something, you know, went outside, and came to the forest. And there he met the similar aged boy living in the forest. And the little boy in the forest said, "What mark did you get in school?" He said, 5, which meant very good. He said, "That's terrible," said the other little boy. "You should get a 3, and then they'll throw you out of school." You know? So that was the way the Jewish spirit was was being kept up. Yes. And of course, it wasn't like that for everyone, and they got absorbed in the whole system, and there were plenty of people informing on other people and terrible things. You know, the great image in Russia was the child informing about his parents. I think the beginning of Glasnost, the very, very beginning, was when this icon of the boy who informed on his parents was somehow stopped being part of the national curriculum to teach about that boy. That was the very beginning of the thaw in Russia.
But they couldn't keep kashrut for
anything. No, well, it was an extremely difficult thing to do. There were people who did it with great difficulty, but it was you couldn't have a shop selling kosher food. It all had to be done in a clandestine. Well, that's right. You go to you could go to a market and get a chicken, a live chicken. Then you have to find a Jewish shochet.
Yeah.
And he would go into the cellar and, slaughter the chicken in the cellar. Let it, you know. And then if the neighbors would see, then you would have a problem.
It must have been terrible.
Yeah, it was. An amazing, amazing experience. However, you see, the point is, this brings out, through the fact of going through this being crushed, through this challenge, that is what actually brings out the oil. And it's not just oil to light the lamp. It's the oil for the luminary, because it is inwardness. It's the oil inside their very soul which is coming out. You know, so that's why it says, why does it say oil for the luminary and not oil for the light? It's because we're talking about the source of the light inside the person. And that comes about through this kind of oppression and struggle. Now, it then goes in, if you can look on page Lamed Zayin 37, section Hay. We're skipping a bit. No, we're skipping. We're moving ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You have it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Yesh Levayzeh, now this can be explained in terms of the idea. The fact that the Jewish people have a belief in God, they don't need proofs for God, is for two reasons. We're going into the traditional idea that basically the individual does believe in God. Okay, one knows people who say they don't believe in God, but deep down, they do, and let's try to understand this. One is Lefi Shemazlayu Chazeh. That's an amazing idea. That the soul which is above sees godliness. There's the idea that the person, let's go back to trying to understand the maker, the nature of a person, and okay, so that's the person. And there is a quality of the person which is beyond. You see, this is what's called the mazal, is really a part of the soul. It's the soul which is beyond. There's the soul inside the person, and there's also the soul beyond the person. Now, the soul which is beyond the person sees godliness. It sees godliness. And so therefore the soul sees godliness, so that pours down a little bit of awareness into us as well. That causes that the soul in the body also believes in God. So there's a kind of a connection. Because the soul above sees godliness, so that leads to a kind of a percolating down in some way. Now, every person has got this spiritual dimension.
You mean you're born with it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're born with a certain spiritual dimension which is beyond us. And that's, it's beyond our ordinary intellect. And it's got a perception of godliness. And most of the time we're unconscious of that. But sometimes that feeds down into us, and sometimes we become aware of it, and sometimes that causes sudden changes of heart inside a person. The person starts thinking about things in a new way, and it's all because of this flow which is coming down. There's even a verse, V'nozlim, the flow, milvanon, lev, Nun, the heart, Lev, and Nun is 50, the 50 gates of understanding. So there is a flow which is coming down from the 50 gates of understanding above into the heart. And so that is the flowing from Lebanon, Levanon. Lebanon is, it's a line in the Song of Songs, like streams flowing from the cedars of the forests of Lebanon. But internally, it's that the 50 gates of understanding, there's a flow, like a river flowing into the person's heart. And that gives the person some extra spiritual awareness.
So even if you're a bad person, you still have a soul?
Absolutely. Yes. Very much so. Even more. The bad person may have a particularly beautiful soul. And the soul is very unhappy inside the bad person. I mean, are people bad? You know, people do bad things. So the bad things that people do oppress their soul. So if the person can change their ways, then their soul will be happier.
In other words, if you're bad, you're not happy.
Well, the soul's not happy. Because the soul wants to be good. The soul wants to be connected with God. But we can do things which are the opposite of that. And that oppresses the soul. Just as if, you see, the soul is captive with us. So the soul inside this person, now this person goes and does something really horrible. He's dragging the soul with him. And the soul is bitterly upset.
So is that the paradox, the dichotomy of being a human being?
That certainly is, yes, exactly, yes. That on the one hand there's something deeply spiritual inside us, and at the other hand we also have desires, or we get into situations where we betray that spirituality. Mm.
And deeply devilish.
And deeply devilish, yes. Yes. Now then, there is another concept which is the source of faith. And it doesn't come from this level. It comes from a higher level. And at the higher level, where we can talk about the essence, there is this level of bonding with the essence, of being connected to the essence. Now, normally that is dormant, and we're not aware of it at all. Little as we're aware of our soul, of our mazal, seeing godliness, we're much less aware of this essence. The level of being inspired by this sort of perception of spirituality, that does happen in various ways.
Mm.
Part of the artistic process. There are all kinds of ways in which this comes out in some sense in a person's life. But the essence, that's something deeper, which is more rare and more precious. And the fact, and the thing is, that it's this kind, you know, so the level of the perception that the soul perceives godliness, so let's call that perception, right? Perception. That level, that visionary level, visionary perception, that visionary level is inspiring, but the inspiration can ultimately have a superficial effect. We can be inspired one minute, and the next minute we can do the opposite. And that is the amazing thing about certain kinds of inspiration, that although we're inspired and we feel it very much, but then it fades away, and then, you know, we go cold. And we go cold, and we can really betray what that inspiration meant. Obviously, if you have a person with a very consistent character, they're not going to allow that to happen, or they're going to try to prevent it happening. But it's a possibility.
Mm.
Whereas when the connection is to the essence, it's not subject to hot or cold. See, visionary perception, either it's switched on or it's not. Whereas when you're connecting at the level of the essence, it's such a deep bond that it's always on. Right? Now, if you remember at the beginning, he asked questions about evening and morning, contrasting with continual light, eternal light. These are these two qualities. Because the visionary perception, there's morning when it's bright, you know, there are times when it's working well, and there are times when it's not working well. Whereas the essence is always working well. And what the role of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, the faithful shepherd, the shepherd of faith, what his role is, what the role of Jewish leadership is to connect our essence to God. So there are lots of ways in which we can engender a bit more of this visionary perception, and we can become more aware and more excited and more enthusiastic. All that is very good. But there is also a quality of bonding the essence, and that's something even more.
What do you mean when you're saying that's something even more? Can you quantify that a bit more?
It's more reliable. It becomes more the reality of the person. Because
the undercurrent, isn't it? It's always there.
Yes, yes.
It's the foundation in a way.
Yeah, and that's why it is less. You see, what I use is the word superficial. In Hebrew, it's surrounding, like a radiance which surrounds. It's not actually in the person. Whereas if it's in, then that's what the heart and the mind feels. So visionary things can be very, very beautiful, and it takes you at that point.
Yeah.
But then,
you know, gets lost in the humdrum.
Yes.
In the desires, in the whatever, the more mundane. Isn't it? That I'm saying about the visionary.
Absolutely,
absolutely. You get drawn back into the mundane thing. The next thing.
You see, the essence is not bothered about the mundane.
Mm.
The essence can take the mundane as well. You could almost describe this in terms of relationship between a husband and a wife. So you can have a kind of, a tremendous gush of love, but in fact, it's superficial. And when you get down to mundane life, like you say, waking
up.
It's
ephemeral, isn't it?
That's right. Whereas there can be a bond which is so deep that it goes through thick and thin, it goes through every aspect of life. It's there as a total, firm, permanent bond with the help of God. That's the real bonding of essence to essence. But it's a very good point to question what is that. Now, the discourse goes on, and it's got very late, and we're not going to explore it more in the text. It goes on to talk about the way that when faced with crisis, like in the time of Mordechai, the Jewish people faced by Haman, and for that matter, the time of the previous Rebbe in Russia, where his Hasidim are facing these terrible things from the Bolsheviks, and they are trying to help strengthen Judaism. It's at that point that they went beyond the visionary perception, and they were reaching the level of the essence.
It's challenging us, isn't it, to that?
Absolutely. And that was all in a time of crisis. Now, crisis, challenge. Now, what about, then the discourse goes on. What about when it's not a time of crisis? What about when it's a time of plenty and everyone has enough to eat and everyone can do what they like and they can make shiurim in their homes and they can do this and that and they can fill Trafalgar Square with people singing Jewish songs? It's a completely different kind of image. What about in that situation? He says then there is a deeper yearning which could be there. And that yearning is a yearning for Mashiach. Now, why should there be a yearning for Mashiach? Because the basic desire of every Jew, maybe we'll just look at this text as well, which this is the bit of this, one second. Yeah. Now, this, in this, it's page Lamed Tet, Va'inyan Hu. Va'inyan Hu. Yeah, that's right, at the bottom. Okay. Va'inyan Hu. Okay. Va'inyan Hu. Thank you. You've got it, Philip. Right. Va'inyan Hu. Va'inyan Hu. The idea is, the fact that the Jewish people feel broken, not because of the pressures, but from the very fact of being in exile. Mizeh shehem begalut, from the fact of being in exile. Gam kashiyesh lehem hachava, even when they have luxury, begashmiut, in physical terms, and even uberuchniut, in spiritual terms. There's a synagogue on every corner. There are spiritual groups, there are all kinds of study and music. It's lovely, it's beautiful. Why do they, in theory, really the Rebbe's talking about himself. Mm-hmm. He felt this yearning for Mashiach. Mm-hmm. Why does he feel this yearning? Why should we feel that yearning? Hu ki ritzono ha'amiti shel kol echad mi'Yisrael. It's because the true desire of every individual Jew is that godliness should be revealed in the whole world. Until this idea of the revelation of godliness in the whole world really affects his own inner being. Therefore, the fact that at the time of exile, godliness does not shine kama shehaya bizman habayit, at the way it did in the time of the temple. He named Mizeh Atzmo, from this itself, he puts it in Yiddish, is there in ganzen zu treselt, he's completely shattered inside himself from the fact that there isn't that revelation of God that there should be. So therefore, we're now looking at the challenge in a time of plenty. It's not a time of crisis. It's a time of plenty. It's a time of luxury. And there's still a challenge. And the challenge is to feel the yearning that there should be the revelation of the divine in the whole world. And the person sees that it's not like that. Now, there are some people, and this is something that goes right back to the beginning of Hasidism. There are some people who are so spiritual that for them it's as if the temple were never destroyed. For them personally, they are living in the time of the Messiah. Right? Now, what about them? Don't they feel okay? Well, they might. And for the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that was a problem. Because it means that they're only thinking about themselves.
The others are not.
Because the others are not feeling this. And so for the facts, so then he goes on. V'gam kushu, the last line on this page. V'gam kushu b'da'aga na'alit b'yoteh. Even on, if he's on such an exalted level, Shemeya etzlo, that there shines for him gilui elokut, turning over the page to Mem, that there shines to him a revelation of God, b'dugmat hagilui shahaya b'zman abayit, in the way it was revealed in the time of the temple. So that's wonderful for him or her. Mikol makom, nonetheless, mizeh shebichlalut ha'olam, from the fact that in the world in general ein meyer hagilui, the radiance doesn't shine, the revelation of God doesn't shine. Muchach, that proves shegam agilui shemei etzlo, that even that which shines to him or her who gilui mugbal is a limited revelation. The kushemei gilu oen sof abligvul, because when the true infinite shines, the revelation hagilui hu b'chol makom, the revelation is everywhere. O kasheyeshnu makom echad, and if there's one place, afilu pinali dachat, some remote corner, she'ein me'asham gilui lakut, where the godliness doesn't shine, hu mipnei shagilui hu gilui mugbal, it's because the shining is limited. And so therefore, there is a yearning. So the situation in a time of plenty, of luxury, even a spiritual luxury, the response that the Rebbe is teaching is yearning. And that yearning, a yearning for Mashiach, a yearning that godliness should truly be revealed in the whole world in the proper way. Not just that there should be peace, there should be peace, but a real peace and a wholesomeness everywhere, for every human being in the world. And the yearning, and that every human being should be sensitive to the oneness of the infinite. And that will be in a way of healing and goodness, with nothing negative happening in the world. And the yearning for that, he then goes on to say, bonds people to God in a really intense way, and also bonds them to each other in a very intense way. And that is the role of the Moses, and the Moses in each generation, to bond us to God and to bring out this quality of faith in God, and to bring out our quality of being bonded to God by the essence, and that should be not only in a time of crisis but also in a time of plenty, to bring out that sense of yearning which bonds all of us to God and to each other to a greater extent.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly, I wrote to you about after